it does go fast. I mean, the technology will develop even further. As long as we humans remain vigilant, remain conscious and responsible, I think it can be a good development.
This is What Now, the latest in the Ludic Insights podcast series hosted by Paul Ashcroft and Garrick Jones, partners and co-founders of Ludic and the co-authors of the best-selling books Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations, and The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to the What Now Ludic Insights podcast, Series 2. This series focuses on exploring the most influential perspectives and conversations on the current and future trends that are affecting the way we live, work, and learn. What Now since the huge pivot to digital-enabled life in 2020 as a result of the pandemic? What now for individuals, society, and business? What now for healthcare, finance, energy, marketing, travel, aerospace, manufacturing, technology, all of it? What now in the multiverse and the omni-channels and the inspiring, incredible, astonishing story of being human in the 21st century? My name is Garrick Jones, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Irinya van den Bigelaar. Hi, Irinya.
Hi, Garrick. Pleasure to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Irinya is managing partner of Buster Group and a driving force of the digital transformation practice and director of advanced analytics, data science, and AI at Ortec in the Netherlands. And I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with you, Irinya, about digital transformation and AI and data analytics and what that means for our lives today and how it's changing our lives and how it impacts us as humans. So...
and quite a lot, I would say.
It's quite a lot. I agree. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Irinya? What brings you to the point of being this expert in data analytics, AI, and digital transformation?
Well, actually, it started a long time ago with my fascination for computers, because at university, I learned that I really was helped by computers. It made me much more productive, effective, although I can't program myself. But I'm a great favorite of the Macintoshes, where you really can use an easy interface. My career always centered around data, databases, computers, but also on the intersection of commerce, business, and business development. And in 2004, we founded Buster Group with some CIOs. We helped organizations with improving their IT management within their organizations. And in 2014, the world changed. You got more off-the-shelf software, outsourcing. So we also changed our business much more towards digital transformation and what that means for organizations. And out of digital transformation, well, one of the big parts in digital transformation is AI, artificial intelligence. And that really fascinated me. So how can you get insights, prediction from data, and improve your own businesses with that? And I really looked at what is necessary for organizations to be able to start and scale that, because there's enough data scientists with much more mathematical capabilities than I am. But as with my MBA, I'm a bit more, say, ready to look at the more organizational aspects of that.
You speak business as well as computer.
Both, yes. Yes, luckily. At this moment, that's my advantage.
It's so valuable. You know, so many people have different interpretations of what digital transformation means. I mean, to your mind, what is your definition of digital transformation?
Yeah, good question. I mean, if you ask 100 people, you get 99 different answers. And they're all a bit centered around the concept. I have a very simple definition of digital transformation. That is... what do you need to do to adapt, change, grow, and thrive in the digital age? So how can an organization remain or improve its competitive positioning helped by digital technologies? And that can be in many different situations. So there's not one thing as digital transformation. Digital transformation is not a mean. It's not an end. It's a mean.
It's getting somewhere, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, yes. And you can see digital transformation in the aspects of your business, like engaging with your customers. If you have an omni-channel, really easy to use app, you're engaging much better with your customers. You get data from your customers. You get a 360 view, so you can better anticipate on their wishes and needs. Mm. But also in your operations can help you realize high efficiencies. If you can predict how many customers you will get in your retail store next week, next month, you can plan and optimize your operations. Two more important aspects, that's products. If you can create smart products, you get direct insights on the behavior of your products. And even you can change your business model from selling the actual product to selling the result, like per kilometer, per kilowatt hour, per light, whatever. Mm. And then, of course, your employees. You can really help your employees with digital technologies, like the maintenance engineer with a smart helmet, with the augmented reality glasses, can see the blueprint of the machine he has to service. Yeah. So there's many aspects of digital transformation that can help your organization to improve.
So you're saying it's touching everything, and I agree with you. It's touching the employees, and it's touching the organization itself. It's touching how we do work using digital stuff, touching the customers, but most importantly. And then there's also the data element. As you say, we're able to gather data and use the data and the analytics to kind of help us make decisions and so on. I love that, how broad your view of digital transformation is, saying it's not an end, but it's also a means of getting it's enabling organizations to make the leap across the abyss in some way.
And because it's so broad, it can also be confusing for organizations. So I think it's important that it starts with having an objective. So what do you actually want to do? What's the problem you want to solve? Mm. There's lots of organizations that starts where the CEO has talked with his buddy on the golf club, say, hey, I'm doing something with AI. We need to do something with AI too, because it's good for our share price. But I think that's the wrong start. I mean, the right start is where is a business problem that you can solve?
Paul is not with us today, my business partner. And we wrote a book in 2019 called Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations. And we've just been doing the next post-pandemic version of that book. So it's very alive for me, this topic. And there were some things we really were starting to understand then, and some things we understand much better now, having gone through this pandemic where there's been such a focus on digital being the lifeline and ways to keep things alive. And one of the things we talked about was a concept we called ad-appability, which is the idea that the future of organizations may be about applications only, that you have applications for your employees, applications for your customers, and you want to change the organization strategically. You change the apps and the group of apps that you have that enable your platform and your ecosystem to work. What would you say to that idea?
For sure, interesting. I'm not sure if I totally understand the thinking. What I do think is that organizations need to become much more flexible to anticipate and encounter all the fast developments in the context of their business. Mm. So instead of applications, I would say think in terms of microservices, APIs, where you really can, from a technology point of view, can adapt your platform or your infrastructure quickly to new circumstances. So monoliths are out of the question. They are really rigid, soon legacy. But if you have a flexible structure of microservices and APIs, you can stitch together the application that you need really fast. So in that sense, if you mean applications with quickly stitched together solutions, I agree.
Mm. Plug and play. Some respects, I think that's what we were getting at early days.
Yeah.
If you're talking to a CEO or the board, what would you say are the most important things to pay attention to now in terms of digital transformation?
I think that there's in large organizations, data management is still a big issue. We can talk about digital transformation, but data there is a key element. And we've always looked at data as a sort of byproduct from doing business. But now it's a valuable asset. And that asset needs to be maintained. But we're not really used to that. So That's why you see now the rise of the chief data officer who is taking care of the quality of the data in an organization, getting it out of the silos data. Because that's also a big issue. You know, this is my data and you're not allowed to touch it.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be shared.
Yeah, you need to share your data. And with that comes also privacy security. I mean, you don't want your data to be spread around all over the place.
Yeah.
So data is a big thing. In digital transformation, I would also urge CEOs to educate their people. I mean, it's data or digital transformation is not a technology thing. Digital transformation is a business thing. And it's helped by the technology guys and the data guys. But the business should know what they want to do, which new innovations they want to launch, which problems they want to challenge. So therefore, a certain level of data literacy within the board, within the business people, is important.
You talked about the shift in microservices and also the rise of the chief data officer. These are fundamental changes in the way that business has been done. You talked about earlier about the primacy of the customer and then, of course, data. Are there other things that you think underpin the big change in how business is delivering services and solutions to the market?
Well, things go faster. I mean, the connections are closer. Mm. We are all, the incumbents, the companies who were here before the digital age have been taken by surprise, I think, by the speed which the digital transformation or the digital era came up. I mean, you all see it coming slowly, slowly, and then suddenly, and then you're too late. Good example is the guys from Nokia who lost out on their mobile telephone business after Apple came with the iPhone. And they had 7 years, but after 7 years, they said, well, we didn't do anything wrong, but just we lost out. They had a blind spot or they were arrogant, I don't know, but they were certainly overwhelmed, as did Borders and Barnes & Noble, who got wiped away by Amazon. Yeah. So another thing for CEOs is keep a close eye, have somebody really do some environment scanning, look out for technologies. What can that mean for your organization and how do you anticipate that?
I know some organizations are actually trying to deal with this specifically by setting up new rival organizations under a separate brand and doing it without anybody knowing, so that if they need to make the leap to a new way of delivering the services, they can do it. So they kind of set up the new child, if you like, using the whole new digital ecosystem, because the barriers to entry are so different. Changed and come down. You can enter so much more quickly with a full range of services, putting things together.
There's quite some companies who did set up a separate digital entity. But I see that also companies are reversing that trend, because installing a separate digital entity can create some crossed eyes with the people who are in the business. And I think that you shouldn't start a separate entity. It's much better to start within your own organization some initiatives and educate the people in becoming data-driven, data-minded, data-literate.
It's a knowledge transfer and skills growth rather than some skunk works out in the desert, which is building things separately.
I don't believe in the skunk works approach.
Mm. Why is that? Do you think it harms the mothership?
Well, it was the idea was to better disrupt yourself than that somebody else disrupts you.
Mm.
But I think that there's a lot of knowledge inside the organization, and you should mobilize that knowledge, educate people and help them and illustrate what's possible. And then you can, I think, release much more energy within the organization than setting it apart.
It's fascinating because we talk about AI and we talk about digital transformation and all the things that computerization and the internet brings us, but fundamentally, you seem to be saying that the most important thing are people, and the people in the organization are at the heart of what the change is going to be. Is that what I'm hearing?
I definitely think so, yes. And some people will be afraid or hesitant or outright not willing. If you help people understanding what it is, what it does, and you give them some education and some help, there's a lot of people that really will embrace digital technologies. I mean, if you position AI as it's going to destroy your job, or you're going to position AI as it's going to help your job. It's a different frame. And a lot of situations, I have to admit, it will destroy some jobs. But in the most more situations, it will really help you in your job.
Do you have some stories for us about how AI is bringing good change, shall we say, to the world?
Well, simple thing. Look at Google Maps. I mean, I was in South Africa driving around, and I was exploring roads I would never have dared to explore without Google Maps. And it's doing a great job directing you to the right roads if there's a traffic jam. So that's a smart product, which is really, really convenient for all of us. That's the first thing. There's a great example of a small butcher in North London where they put a camera in the shop to make an inventoryation of all the passers-by. So how many people walk by at what time? And they've got so much data that they started a 12 o'clock at Friday, Saturday night burger joint for everybody who came out of the bar to deliver a burger. So that's a very simple but illustrative example of how AI can help. Or this was more data science.
Sure.
And I think we should also elaborate a bit on AI and the ways how people think about it. But this was a data analytics effort that really helped that butcher get a lot of more business. So it's not only for big companies, it's for small companies.
I love that. So you've got a camera which is tracking the number of people who are going past minute by minute, and then you see an opportunity in the market and you can build something to complement a burger joint for the butcher.
They even analyzed that putting a sign up with prices wasn't that very effective, but putting up a sign with our delicious stew is fresh today, then people came in. I mean, so you can analyze a lot of things, and data really helps you with new ideas, with improving your business.
How would you define AI then for us, artificial intelligence?
Artificial intelligence, I define it as computers that does things that seems human, like thinking, reasoning, listening, speaking, reading. That's the most broad definition that I can give out on AI. Artificial intelligence isn't new. I mean, it's been launched in the 50s of the former century. You remember the Alan Turing test?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So that was sort of first idea of artificial intelligence, a computer that could think and understand if a people or a person said something. But that was based on, let's say, if this, then that, else programming. So it became very laborious. But then in the beginning of this century, you got the machine learning approach. So not learning from written rules, but learning from data. So getting inferences and making predictions based on data. And then in the, let's say, 2013, we got the neural networks, the deep learning. And that gave a huge jump into the applications of artificial intelligence, because then computer vision and text translation became possible.
Is that the neural networks when they're starting, they kind of making connections and they're starting, the software is starting to learn itself and change itself?
Well, the machine learning is computers that learn, or algorithms that are modeled and use data to make predictions. Mm-hmm. And that is really data-based. Deep learning or neural networks is also data-based, of course, but it has a different approach and therefore a different methodology, and therefore it's much more powerful. So the AlphaGo from DeepMind, the company that was founded in London in 2013, they developed AlphaGo. That was a reinforcement learning algorithm and trained with deep learning techniques. And it beat Lee Sedong in the Go game, which was supposed to be the most difficult task. And that was a real jump start for deep learning networks.
You're listening to What Now? The latest in the Ludic Insights podcast series. Follow hashtag What Now on Twitter and LinkedIn.
And what do deep learning networks do for us that sort of more traditional databases or other types of computation? How do they change the game?
Well, they change the game in terms that they can really make high, powerful predictions fast. Like Machine translation is, or a text translation is based on deep learning algorithms. Mm. Computer vision is based on deep learning algorithms. So for instance, a Tesla, a self-driving car, gets input from a lot of sensors that it has on board. And with all those data is being analyzed, and it almost instantaneously predicts accelerate, brake, go left or go right, based on all the data that it gets in. So the deep learning algorithms are able to work with a lot of different data and very fast and very accurate. The drawback is that it's less transparent. So something happens there and we are not really able to explain what happens. So we know that the outcome is good, but it's a bit of a black box.
I remember you and I have both been conferences and think tank together where we were looking at some of the futurist stuff and some of the stuff that's coming down the line, but it was clear that some of the central policymakers and so on and policy and government was way behind the curve in terms of what's happening in, you know, whichever real world you want to talk about. But in terms of computation, analysis, connection, you know, cross-border computation and all of the stuff related to the shifts in business and that, it would seem that policymakers are behind the ball. And I was wondering if you had a view on how that's going to change, or whether the policymakers will become irrelevant, or whether they're going to have to catch up to deal with the changes that are happening in society as a result of all of this.
Well, what I see in the Netherlands now, there's a great appetite for knowledge within our policymakers and government employees. So I think that they're doing already quite a good job, at least in the Netherlands, and in England also. You have a lot of smart data scientists within the government doing smart things. Similarly in the Netherlands, even on a European scale, there's more and more, let's say, awareness for AI and how to handle it. There's more and more privacy regulations, governance regulations for AI, and I think that's a good thing. So slowly but surely, they will adjust to this new normal and make AI and digital technologies a part of their doing business. By the way, digital transformation does not include only AI. It's also augmented reality. It's robotics, 3D printing. So all those digital technologies that can help companies or organizations innovate are subject of digital transformation.
I like that very much, because I was going to ask you about AI and digital transformation. Is what you're saying is that it's much broader. The digital transformation not only incorporates AI and deep learning and so on, but it also incorporates all these other new technologies, hyperlocal and so on, which are impacting our daily lives. Let's play a game, if you like, for the both of us. How do we think this may change our lives in society, and what are some of the things that are happening, like weak signals that we think will have an impact on daily life?
Well, the thing that pops to my mind directly is the metaverse that's being promoted now. It's far away, but a lot of companies are jumping on this bandwagon. Personally, I've seen some videos on how the metaverse is going to look. I'm not sure that I'm going to be a great fan of the metaverse at this moment. I really would like people to communicate and converse live. I think that's much more valuable.
True. I agree.
Another thing is what really surprises me is the non-fungible tokens.
Yes.
I mean, you pay a lot of money for something that you don't own, but you have a sort of ownership certificate. All the people can use it, and you own it, but you don't really own the IP. So I don't get that yet. Maybe I'm not smart enough for that.
I can tell you my own experience. I want to continue this experiment, but my own experience, I wanted to learn about NFTs, and an artist who I like and collect launched a print version of his art, and you could buy a piece of art like normal, but he also at the same time launched an NFT version. And what you were able to do was purchase the token. I had to get a digital wallet in order to do this. And then you could use the token, and I can trade that token to anybody for money or cryptocurrency or whatever. Yeah. But what it means is that the person at some point in the future, there's no date, can actually come to the gallery and exchange that token for the real thing, or they can choose to not use that, and then the real thing is going to be destroyed, and they will continue to trade the token. And for me, it was a fantastic opportunity to spend a little bit of money to learn what this means. And what I learned was that it's actually about a token. What you're doing is you're trading a token, a thing. You don't own it, but you have the right to trade it. And what was fun was I could have traded it back into the real thing, which I've not chosen to do just yet. But we'll see how it plays out. Unfortunately, the trading hasn't begun yet, so I don't know whether I made a wise investment and I'm going to, you know, suddenly have hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, but you're the proud owner of a non-fungible token, so
correct.
That's worth something.
I hope so. But I think it was worth the knowledge.
What I don't get, and that's something to what I should explore, is it's all digital. I mean, it's the most NFTs are about digital images. And so you can't get it, you got to own it. So for me, as far as I understand, for me, it's the most extreme form of conspicuous consumption. Like I own this NFT, I don't have anything, I can trade it, but I don't have it. It's like having a car or buying a car, which everybody can drive and say, I own it, but actually you don't own it. I mean, I don't get it.
Well, Volvo are now offering subscription service. So you purchase a subscription to a Volvo. That means they give you a car to drive around, and they're essentially helping you with transportation. But you don't own the car. You just subscribe to this piece of transportation.
That's a different thing. There you have you get, let's say, physical.
A service.
A tangible service. I mean, yeah, you get a timeshare on a car.
Yeah.
And that's different than a token on a digital thing that you don't own, or you own it, but you don't have it.
But you have other things. You have non-tangible things. At the moment in Silicon Valley, you have, you know, you have bragging rights. You can go to your party with your friends and you can go, I bought this ridiculous thing for 700,000 Ethereum. And that makes you a dude. So I think it's early days. Where it becomes interesting is when the barriers to entry to raising cash and money become so low that you can actually solve refugee crises. You can solve hunger, education, housing, because it's possible to raise money and trade money in an easy way for people.
So that's the cryptocurrency area.
Yeah.
And cryptocurrencies will probably have a role to play.
Yeah.
I'm not into cryptocurrencies myself.
Well, I wasn't until I bought this piece of art. Now, I had a student who 8 years ago was saying to me, Carrick, you've got to get Bitcoin. And he's done very well, but he got in really early days. But I never did. I never did. I don't know why. I think I like to watch and see where it's going.
I had a friend who bought the cryptocurrency on, say, one dime. So he's in good shape now.
He's in good shape, yes. The student of mine, the last I heard, was living in Costa Rica because that's where he could spend his money. But he couldn't do it elsewhere. And there are lots of Bitcoin people doing work in Costa Rica, apparently. I mean, it's fascinating. One of the other things, the big changes I think are coming up, is hyper-local manufacturing. I know hyper-local production of food and what they call continuous urban production landscapes, CEPULs, where the food is farmed and grown in micro farms within the cities. I think that's coming fast, and the Dutch are very much at the forefront of that. But the other thing is hyperlocal manufacturing of products and services. So, for example, I would go online, I would find a recipe card for a pair of Nikes. When it's branded, it's non-fungible, it's branded by them, but it's been designed by Nike designers. Perhaps it has the solution, just to say I'm not funded by Nike on this podcast, but any of the big brands. And then I choose my trainers and they go effectively printed out at some local manufacturing, I mean, probably not a mile from where I live, and I pick it up or it gets delivered. A combination of NFTs and micro manufacturing.
Yeah, but also 3D printing. The customization is huge. I mean, with the normal production approaches. It was efficiency of scale, so a lot of the same, and that was the best way to produce. But now with the more advanced capabilities of designing digital products and then printing them out in a 3D printer, you get so much more opportunities to run, let's say, very small batches.
That's right.
Individual batches of one. Yeah, that's becoming possible.
In a way that wasn't before. I mean, as you say, scale was needed to, you know, meet the needs of growing populations. But there's a lot of waste, we know, in the current manufacturing system. So the movement to sort of micro-manufacturing and manufacturing on demand, printing on demand, is going to happen quite quickly. It's much, much more efficient use of resources.
I think it's a good development. Absolutely. Yeah. Bringing back production from China closer to home. It also fits a new thinking of supply chain.
The whole idea of globalization and containerization of manufacturing of objects and having a huge impact on sustainability, as we know, in the environment.
Yeah, and those micro farms, those urban farms, I think that's also a great development. I'm not sure if it's, let's say, economical feasible at this moment, but as soon as they become a bit bigger, larger, then that's going to work. Well, of course, Philips is from the Netherlands, still proud of it. They sold off their lighting business now under Signify. Signify also has a big division for agricultural lighting, and they have those red, blue, yellow lights, and they exactly can give the right amount of light, type of light for each crop that you want to grow.
That's amazing.
So they're also technology is helping tremendously improve.
So you get micro manufacturing, but also micro agriculture with specific lighting conditions for the plants. And then, of course, you know, the development where you can actually put micro drops of nutrients to the plants. It's highly efficient forms of agriculture.
Yeah, by now it's hydroponics. So they don't use earth anymore, but they're floating on water and getting the nutrients from directly from water. That's high tech agriculture.
It's probably the way that things are going to, it's the only way that we can deal with the growing population and deal with the requirements of the earth at the same time.
That's the urbanization that you can counter with that.
It's amazing. I mean, we have such a fascinating conversation, not only about digital transformation and what that means for businesses, but also about what this means, deep learning, AI, and analytics, what this means for us as humans and how it affects our daily lives and how our lives will change. I mean, already, I mean, we have smartphones and you consider how different our lives are with smartphones. And that's only been 10 years, really. Not that long.
Totally product that you can't miss anymore. I mean, how reliant are we on our iPhones?
It's incredible.
It's almost scary. I was on holiday in South Africa. And now if you want to travel, you have to board your plane. I mean, your iPhone is your lifeline. Without iPhone, you don't exist. You can't get on the board on a plane. It's really fascinating. Or almost on a plane.
Yeah. I walked into a room the other day looking for my iPhone and had forgot that I actually had it in my hand.
It happens to me with my glasses. I'm looking for my glasses. I have them on my head.
I mean, I'm enjoying getting older and seeing the world change around us. But it is amazing, you know. Like Paul's son the other day, he's 13 years old, and I was needing help with my computer, and he just comes in and he knows exactly how to do it and where to go. He's completely literate about how to move things around. Yeah. And you know, I think I've been around computers a long time, but it's amazing.
No, I'm beaten by my daughter also. So she's 25 and much more fast and literate on the iPhone than I am.
And their kids, they live in it. It's fascinating. I hope it's good. The idea, just one last word about, you know, friendly AI. You know, people are worried about artificial intelligence and the idea that there could be, you know, the military industrial complex could create robots that are making their decisions about how to kill things and people. The Asimov issue, where you get to a point where the software decides that humans are the weak link in the chain, takes us out. What's your view on how we ensure a non-dystopian future?
Well, first of all, remain critical. Remain very critical on what's going on. I think that there's luckily quite some activist groups who are, let's say, the guards of, let's say, good behavior of AI. And I also think that we all should understand that AI can work for us. There's ideas about that singularity, that AI will take over the world and be smarter than we are. It does go fast. I mean, the technology will develop even further. As long as we humans remain vigilant, remain conscious and responsible, I think it can be a good development.
Rainier, we're running out of time. This is such a fascinating conversation. I'm really enjoying it. I have to ask, if there's one thing for our listeners to take away, what would you like to tell them?
I would say, don't be afraid of AI, but be critical, and don't let it replace your daily life. I would say, what I mean is, I see so many people in the train, in the metro, only watching at their smartphone. But I would urge to keep on conversing with each other. I mean, let's have conversations between humans. I mean, that is really important and enriching and valuable. I'm sometimes a bit sad that we only can interact with our smartphone. Interacting with humans is so much more enriching.
And finally, what excites you about what now in terms of society and what the changes in people and being human?
There's so much possibilities. And if we, as people, as humans, embrace the right options, then we can have a great society. Unfortunately, there's always, let's say, evil empires doing bad things. An evil empire can be Russia at the moment, but an evil empire can also be Facebook. On the other hand, Russia is in itself a great country with great people. And Facebook does things that are, for a lot of people, fantastic, and it helps small businesses. So we have to watch out that we be vigilant for the dark side, but be optimistic on the good side.
That's a great way to end. Thank you, Rainier. Thank you for a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
Likewise, Gareth.
Well, thank you for listening to the What Now? Ludic Insights podcast. What now from you? If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review on your preferred channel saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. And we also appreciate hearing your thoughts and having a What Now conversation. Subscribe and chat in the links below. But remember, we're asking the big questions about what we should be doing. How will we achieve these? And what are some of the weak signals that already exist that may show the way forward? What now? If you're interested in submitting questions, please do so by pinging us directly at our LinkedIn pages and on the Ludic Podcast What Now page. You can also submit names of interesting people and projects that you believe we should feature on this podcast. And we'd be delighted if you join our conversation. Hashtag What Now Ludic Insights. What now? Subscribe today and stay tuned. See you next time.
That's a wrap for this episode of What Now, part of the Ludic Insights podcast series hosted by Paul Ashcroft and Garrick Jones. Follow hashtag What Now on Twitter and LinkedIn. Stay tuned for more and subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, CastBox, iHeart, Listen Notes, Overcast, Podchaser, and Radio Public. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and Jill Damatek-Futter, and edited by Jill Damatek-Futter and Roman Pacherski.